all humans are faced with answering these questions. You know, who am I? What is my identity? What is my responsibility and obligations to myself? And also to the community, or in this case, we could say to other, if we're talking about racial identity, we could say, what is my responsibility and obligation and identity with others that are of my same race, or others that are of my same sex, or in my own community, or in my neighborhood, or my city, or whatever. And then the wider ranging question is, what is my responsibility to the world at large, or to other people not like myself? How do I relate to those people? And you can see that this whole question in so many different areas has been raised in the last 20 years. It's the question of racial self-hatred, the question of opening oneself up to other people, and then the sexual identity too. And I don't mean in this case just copulation, but I'm talking about gender identity. You know, the whole range of what it means to be a man or a woman, or some gradation or extremes in that area. And of course, we always thought about in the past about men and women as if there were those single identities. But you know, and so when you fill out a form, a questionnaire or something that says male or female, you know, M or F, you know, and you check one or the other. But in reality, it's not a lot like that. People don't think of themselves as just one thing or one other thing. In other words, sex itself now has become sort of a continuum. You know, on one end you have maybe some pure cultural ideal of male and the other female, maybe these archetypes, but everybody is strung out some place along that continuum somewhere. And it's not stable where they are. In other words, they're moving as one grows and matures or develops different attitudes and has different experiences.
One of the things that I thought of when Ron read that newspaper article, in Romans, where I live, the churches have made an effort to have family nights and family activities. But their definition of a family is this nuclear unit that is the minority within the population. And although I'm a single person, I've been to these affairs.
You were
with another, you know, with a, as part of a church, working for the church. And I never see any single mothers there, or, you know, families that are headed by a woman. It's like the same people come over and over and over again, and this outreach or sense of inclusiveness is just horrid. And I think the church has this ideal of a family, and they're not reaching out, at least in the rural area where I live, to where society's really at.
On the other hand, from a family point of view, I think that might be happening because there are so many limited opportunities for families anyplace else other than church. And like, it became really distressful for us in the last few years when Holden seemed to be less family geared, where family was almost discouraged because we didn't have any place else to go for a family vacation that we could afford. You know, other than a place like Holden, we don't have any place as a family that we can afford to go and have a good time, but to our church. You know, it's too bad. But I think that might be one of the reasons why, is because...
Yeah.
But the definition of family, I'm not against the church having a family activity. What I'm questioning is that, what is the church portraying as an appropriate family? I mean, is appropriate family a woman who has to have a man in that picture?
Well, I wanted to get at that today, too. Let's come back to that, because I wanted to read you a few quotes and then on that very subject, and then get your response to those. Part of this identity course, has to do with one's relationship, the number one there. Who am I in relation to myself, identity? When we're talking about sexual identity, it becomes clear that there's this other opposite side that one has to relate to. In other words, my understanding of myself as a male has a lot to do with what I think about females and my relationship to females. And then I'm sure that women think the same thing, that part of their identity and search for identity has to do with that they have to think occasionally about what is their relationship to men, you know, or to the other sex. And that formulates part of, and maybe a major part of one's understanding of oneself. It's the contrast, you know, so that if you grew up, use another example, if you grew up in a society where everybody is pretty much alike, you know, the same ethnic or racial group, and you don't have any contrasts, then maybe it's just, well, the only contrasts that are natural in that kind of setting are sexual contrasts. You're always going to have male and female. And age contrasts, older, younger. And probably the other one has to do with status or hierarchy, you know, how much power or influence or status a person has. And but those are almost always based on sex and age, too, in those kinds of societies. So, still, sex is a basic form always, no matter what kind of society it is, of one's identity. So I wanted to, I was going to end up today by talking about that a little bit, and so that's why I wanted you to read the myth of Psyche and Eros, or Amor. How many people have had a chance to read that? Anybody?
I loved Amor.
It was in the book Bullfinch's Mythology?
Well, I found the book, but I had no idea anymore which one, and there was no, the marker was in a different place, and I read that, and I thought, no, that doesn't make sense. That
which one was in Sybil?
And I couldn't find you to ask you which one it was, where it was at.
That was on page 60. I probably should have said that.
The marker was in the place on Sybil.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I hadn't put a marker in it, so I thought you'd just look it up in the index.
And so I started reading that, and I thought this doesn't make sense.
Well,
George, I have a question for you. When you say sex, like in the last thing, do you mean gender?
Uh-huh.
Okay, just
right. Sorry. Or gender identity. The distinction usually is, you know, sex is like a biological thing, whereas gender has to do with socialization and the role that one plays and is taught to play, or the one feels or comes to the understanding that one needs to play as a male or as a female.
Gender doesn't mean male or female.
Well, it's usually, we talk about gender roles, male or female, but there's a lot of variation, obviously, within each of those.
Right.
And some people maybe aren't happy with their particular gender role. But that becomes apparent, and I wanted to get at that too, in relationship to the other sex, that lots of times people aren't happy with their gender role because of not just themselves alone, but because the way they relate or feel they relate to the other sex or the way the other sex relates to them. The interesting thing about the myth of Psyche and Eros is that psyche, of course, is a word that we use a lot these days, and it's translated in Greek as soul, S-O-U-L. That's the Greek word for soul. And Eros, of course, is this emotional, romantic love. So it's an interesting myth to see the archetypes of male and female as they relate. Psyche, or soul, is a woman in the story, and Eros is a man. And so essentially what the story is, you know, myths are those things that get at basic truths that are so basic that we have trouble verbalizing them. And so we feel those truths, and the myth or poetry and that kind of writing or stories are meant to get us in touch with how we feel about things. Well, because you can't really be precise, there's a lot of different interpretations that are going to come out of a myth. And maybe they're all true, you know, because they're dealing with a subjective sense. But maybe there's some that are more true than others. Now, the interesting thing about, I noticed in that book, Bullfinch's Mythology, is that when he interprets the myth at the end of the story, it's obvious that he was writing under the influence of Victorian sexual repression, because he never mentions Eros in his interpretation. the story, as he sees it, is only about psyche. And
Errol Kamen
mentioned in his interpretation. And so it's his interpretation is essentially meaningless, except on a superficial level. But what the just to give you sort of a rundown on the story, Psyche is considered to be the most beautiful woman on earth. She's one of three daughters of a king and queen. And she's so beautiful that people come from all over the world to see her. Okay? And pretty soon she develops this understanding that people are only looking at her for her beauty. They're not looking at her for who or what she really is. And for that reason, nobody wants to marry her, because they can't get over that surface beauty that she has to get to know who she really is. And so nobody becomes intimate with her at all. And so the parents start worrying, you know, this poor beautiful woman is never going to get married. So they, and her, of course, you know, there's a little, the Cinderella and Snow White motifs, you know, are very, there's supposed to be something like 75 different Cinderella Snow White type myths that are available. But there's a lot of correspondence. There's some elements, you know, that we have to see that are pretty consistent across sexual archetypes. But in this case, her sisters get married, you know, so she's left without being married. So the parents go to consult an oracle of Apollo in this case. And Apollo says, well, she'll get married, but she'll not marry any earthly person. She's going to marry an ugly god monster type individual. Remember the myth the other day about the rusty iron hairy man at the end of the psyche? This, or at the end of, you know, the male archetype. This is the picture of the kind of man that she's going to marry, that Apollo gets. Okay, so the parents, you know, they don't know what to do about that, but then they're pretty sad, but they figure, oh, well, you know, that's the way things are. Yeah, at least she's going to be married. So she's told to present herself at the base of this particular mountain where this monster lives on the top, and the wind comes along and carries her up to the top of this mountain. It's a beautiful castle, and you know, a great dinner is spread. Sounds a little about Beauty and the Beast coming in here, too. And the point is, though, that she can't see her husband. He doesn't want to show himself because he's so ugly, and he's a monster. And so when they consummate their marriage, it's always necessary to do it in the dark. You know, so this guy's lying next to her, but he says, if you ever see me, I'm going to have to leave and I'll never see you again. So she can't stand it any longer. So one night she takes a lamp and she lights it and she looks at who this is. And, well, it turns out to be about the most handsome guy around, Eros, who is the son of Venus. And we know him. His names are Amor, Eros, and also Cupid is another word for him. So he wakes up. She drops some hot oil on his arm, and it wakes him up. And he says, you know, I told you so. And so he flees and takes off. Well, then, you know, she really feels bad about that. And so she tries to find him, and she can't find him. And so she turns to her mother-in-law, who happens to be horribly jealous of her and hate her. And mainly because she, when she was living on Earth, she was vying with Venus for the most beautiful, you know, entity around. And Venus got jealous. And so she hated Psyche. And she was, in fact, responsible for some of her unfortunate happenings. Well, lo and behold, who falls in love with Psyche? Venus's son. Right, and so you see this thing between the mother and the wife, you know, or the love object, and he has to give up, you know, and go against his mother too, and falls in love with this woman. So she goes to Venus, and Venus is really angry with her and doesn't want her son to be married to her. So she says, "I'll tell you where to find Eros if you complete these three tasks." You know, and so they turn out to be really dangerous, life and death defying tasks. But she gets a little help from the other gods too in doing it, and so and warnings, and she's told how to go about some of these tasks. But the last one, she has to go down to Hades to visit Persephone, and get a vial of beautiful eyeliner or eyeshadow. It isn't clear which it is, but it's made up of chemical compounds that are very rare. And so Venus wants this eyeshadow, and so she sends Psyche down to Hades to get it, and she thinks, you know, she'll never make it, but she's told how to get around the dogs and the guards and everything. So she goes down and she gets it, and she comes back, and on the way back to Venus, her own feminine attractiveness element takes over. She can't help herself. She opens the vial because she wants to use some of it herself, and it isn't what it's supposed to be, and what it is some kind of horrible gaseous thing that comes out. I can't remember exactly how it's described or where it comes from, but it kills her. You know, it envelops her and knocks her dead, and so she's lying there. Actually, she's asleep, and so Psyche or Eros is off, you know, watching this, and he can't stand it any longer. So he comes to her and kisses her, and you know, she wakes up, and they join back together again, and they have the greatest marriage in the history of the gods that's ever been recorded. And in other words, the happily ever after kind of thing. Now, how is this interpreted, you know, in terms of the male-female archetype? Maybe you can see some elements. First of all, you have the male interest in sexuality that's labeled sometimes paradise in the dark. In other words, it's impersonal. The sex that's involved is this impersonal kind of male sex, where Eros, you know, says, "Look, I don't want to get you to know you or you to know me as a person, but I want to be with you sexually." But we can't get intimate. And obviously Psyche doesn't really love him either, because she doesn't know who he is. And she feels that, you know, on her side, that here's these contrasting elements of intimacy versus romantic sex versus more impersonal and sexual release. And so that is the point. Apparently the point at how men and women come toward one another. You see, that's what they come to the relationship with. And it's the force that drives both of them. On the one side and the other, that's the essential purpose for coming together. But then to get to know one another and to build beyond that into something beautiful takes a withdrawal. And finding themselves, especially Psyche in this case, finding herself as an individual and proving herself, and proving herself worthy in this case, I suppose, but being independent and acting independently or autonomously in order to get the Eros to love her and to admire her and to want to be with her in an open, communicating type of relationship. And then I also mentioned, you know, you have the problem of the man splitting away from his mother in this sense, and denying her.
Well, George, what was the reason that she wanted to get to know him anyway? I mean, is there just supposed to be that genuine need for the other? Is that what drives her to prove herself for him? Because obviously she didn't love him, she didn't know him. So why would she have to prove herself in order to obtain his love?
Well, she did. She saw who it was, you know. She saw this incredibly beautiful, handsome man lying next to her. And it wasn't an ugly monster. Uh-huh. But one wonders what would have happened, you know. And the point is that it's not really... You know, in terms of dealing with the archetypes, the idea is that every man is an ugly monster to begin with, and that it's overcoming that somehow and getting to know getting beyond that, that true love, you know, in the sense that we normally think of people coming together and producing something more that wasn't there to begin with, occurs.
But it was funny because he saw her and saw her beauty, yet he didn't fall in love with her until she proved herself. But all she had to do was see his beauty, and then is am I not getting out of the story?
And like he doesn't need to see himself, it's not reciprocal.
Well, see, this is the question about the archetypes. Mm-hmm. You see, that it's the female. It's the male energy, mm-hmm, that at this basis of the male archetype that brings the two together. That makes the initial attempt or force to make the contact and to begin the relationship. But then let's see. If I have a statement of that. This is what I have written down. The masculine energy gives the impulse and the opportunity for the relationship, and then the feminine nurturance and conservation allows it to go on in enduring effect. But you see, these are being that these are archetypes, the idea is that these are there's a tendency to play these roles naturally. I mean, without even thinking about it. But in the modern context, what we find is that people don't want to just do that naturally. They want to have some choice or feel they're doing it from the basis of making a decision. There's a book by a woman named Olive Schreiner, who is a South African writer. And in her book, Dreams, she has it's an interesting book because she relates different kinds of dreams and she gives interesting interpretations of them. But one of the dreams she has is where this woman is confronted in her dream by life, and life holds in her hands two gifts. One is freedom, and the other is love. And she says to the woman, which do you choose? And the woman thinks about it for a long time, and she says, I'll choose freedom. And life says, well, that was a good choice. If you had chosen love, I would have given you love, but I would have never returned again. But because you chose freedom, I give you freedom now, and then I'll return with both love and freedom in the same hand at a future time. And you see, that gets at the whole idea, and really in a nutshell, that love, and this kind of love, is possible, just as the natural animation of the sex. But what people want also is to know that they've done this from the perspective of being free, a free choosing individual.
What was the I missed it. I think what was the initial motivating force to draw together the male archetype and the female archetype?
Well, the point is that originally it's the male impulse and energy.
Is that sexual energy, or what energy?
Yeah, you know, in some sense, Freud labeled it sexual energy, but it doesn't have to be. You know, creative energy, libido.
Okay.
There's a lot of kinds of terms for it.
So it's just energy, and then the female is.
This is, you know, like the other day we were talking about. I was trying to think of some good examples of how males experience this energy that needs to break out occasionally and let go. And so I was thinking of a good example of that people might be able to understand. But it's the joy of letting go that the men experience, or that you know, every once in a while you just want to just blow it, you know, and just have this enormous release. And we were playing basketball the other day, and so, you know, we were having a nice gentlemanly, womanly, ladylike game, and all of a sudden, you know, Greg, you know, was playing, and he has a bad knee, you know, so he was being careful about not playing too hard, and all of a sudden, you know, like, he runs down court and lets go with this tremendous leap and release of energy, and screws up his knee and has to leave the village. That's very common that men experience this occasionally, you know, and then they get in trouble, or they sometimes they don't, but it's a tremendous exhilaration. And now you're starting to see women do this too, especially women involved in athletics. But I didn't think, you know, growing up like I did back in the olden times, women just didn't do that. They were mostly sedentary, and a heavy release of energy was really unladylike, you know, something that was really frowned upon. But now you see women just really starting to cut loose too occasionally, and discovering the exhilaration that's involved in that.
So how would that be explained then if it isn't? I mean, I'm curious if it isn't part of our identity or what is natural to us. Or have we gone beyond the need to express it or going back to the need to express it or what?
Well, I think we all have those, you know, we both have feminine and masculine sides in us. One tends to be, that's what I was trying to say, one tends to be more natural than the other, though, or it's felt to be more natural. We were talking about that the other day in terms of attractiveness, that historically, you know, all the way back as long as anybody can remember, this has been a characteristic of the female archetype. It doesn't mean that men don't do that or can't do that, too.
But what I was thinking about is in the section about, I don't remember, pornography or something, you're saying that because we're females, we can't possibly understand the chemical drives or the hormonal drives that men have and we need to release. And I'm just wondering now, how come women are beginning to understand that? Are they just discovering their maleness within them more? Or what would you say, not the advancement, but what would you say as a follow-up to that comment?
Well, I think there is a possibility, but like I said, it could be, you know, it could be in terms of empathy, you know, empathetic understanding, or it could be a more natural biological understanding, too, as women get in touch with their male side. And also, I remember back the very first day I was reading you some of the excerpts from the article by Susan Sontag, and she was pointing out, and this is sort of what I'm getting at today, is that in order to get in touch with the loss of self and the discovery of nature that's involved in higher ecstasy of sexual experiences, it's necessary for people to come to a relationship from this aspect of being free and choosing and then playing their parts, but not being scared about playing their parts as a sort of the division of labor of discovering these higher truths that are involved in sexual ecstasy, or being in touch with forces beyond oneself. Now, how many people can do that? You know, I don't know of any polls, you know, or how you'd even measure that. But the analogy was religious ecstasy. You know, when you read about the saints or the people that have been in contact with high levels of spiritual experience. And I keep thinking, you know, of, which I mentioned the other day too, I keep thinking of that matins that Karin read last week about the boy who comes to the Zen master and says, you know, if I work really hard, can I do it in less than 10 years? And the master says, no, that will take 20 years. You know, in other words, it's not something that one comes at naturally or one just discovers. But one has to go through a process of having this occur. It's, you know, the male can come to these relationships, and this is the stereotype, and just looking for this like paradise in the dark. But for him to be able to be ushered in, you know, to have the woman usher him into these higher realms of consciousness that have to do or come out of sex, means that, you know, they both have to work at playing and freeing themselves from stereotypes in such a way and develop a capacity to trust have a real transference of identity in the sex relationship.
What was the female archetype again that you mentioned to go along with male energy archetype? To the initial drawing together of a male and female archetype.
Producing an enduring relationship.
And that's an emotional?
Nurturing and
so there's no female sexual energy or any energy involved in that initial.
Yeah, they both are, but they're different kinds of energies.
So one is what are the energies? That's where I'm not picking it up.
Well, you can think of it in terms of, to say what are the energies. I think one has to talk about it in terms of analogies. It would be like positive and negative poles. It could be that the female is the poles and the male is the electrical energy. And
yeah.
Without one, you can't have the other. I mean, the other won't work without the other.
I guess I have trouble with that. If we're going to put... I'm picking up that we're looking at a female in a nurturing sense and a man's initial reaction for a relationship in a sexual sense. Is that what we're getting down to?
Yeah.
Okay.
The point is that for women, this is a fearful kind of thing. And I wanted to use as a contemporary example of the same thing an analysis of Harlequin novels. Yeah.
In fact, what Jana said a minute ago, I'm getting very confused, and when we're talking about archetypes and when we're talking about that Alana referred to as kind of the set thing, and when we're referring to the cultural stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Because some of that, I don't think we can generalize even back there, but we used the term women, it was more sedate and so on. But there we're getting into the cultural stereotypes, not the archetypes, at least Karen and I were just sharing with me at our experience growing up on a farm. It wasn't anything that kind of a stereotype, of the woman's idea.
But do you remember the stereotype of the Victorian woman who didn't move?
But I just mean we can't generalize. Some of these generalizations is really a cultural thing. That's not really the archetype. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Sometimes what percentage of the population does that actually affect?
Well, I'm not talking about the cultural stereotype. Another example might be women as corporate executives. For a while, within the recent time, women wanted to know, and we're really debating this, what kind of role should they play as a corporate executive? Should they dress in a suit and tie like a man and be hard-driven and throw their weight around? Or should they dress... more of a feminist abandon, with no makeup and less attention to their attractiveness to men, or what? Now, see what has come out is that women did, the way that women are dressed now is, and generally tend kinds of uniforms that wear in business kinds of circumstances. Are really unique, and they're not like men, and they're not like this, the feminist withdrawal from men, but they actually are the same thing that probably people said they should have been in the first place. But that didn't make any sense unless women could step back and choose that. See? Choose to look that way. Choose to look attractive in that kind of a setting. And to play up their female characteristics. So if you had back, 10, 15 years ago just said, women should do that, they would have said, no.
Yeah.
Because it's just playing out some cultural stereotype. But you see, behind that cultural stereotype is something else. It's what women, the archetype is the thing that women feel that's most natural to them. And the elements of their identity that are at the basis of a lot of the cultural stereotypes, but are more fundamental than that. Does that make it clear?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think I just thought that we were kind of confusing ourselves when we were referring to the millennial.
Right. This is an article called Mass Market Romance, Pornography for Women is Different, by Ann Barr Snitow. And I'm just going to read you a few quotes.
Who is she?
What? She's one of the co-authors of a book called, that's been widely reviewed, came out in 1983, called Powers of Desire, The Politics of Sexuality. And she's a sociologist, and she's one of the editors of this book, but it's a series of articles about women's sexuality. And this is one of the articles that's in the book. Now, how many of you are acquainted with Harlequin novels?
I know what you mean.
We've been acquainted with red one?
Yeah. There's not just one kind of female pornography. There's just like there's no one kind of male pornography. Harlequin is a particular type of book. I wish Karin were here. She was going to bring a bunch of books. She reads these apparently, quite a lot of them. But they're formula written, you know, like all pornography is, from one sort or another. And they're formula written so that the person who buys the book knows what they're going to get before they buy the book. So they won't be disappointed.
Yeah. I'm backing up a couple days, but what was the definition of pornography you were using, just to clarify?
Any writing that has its primary function to increase people's sexual interest, or to be sexually exciting. Yeah. And, you know, but most people think of pornography as something they don't like. You know, and the things that they do like, they call erotica, you know, or some other euphemism for pornography. And in fact, those terms may be useful in some sense. Like if we wanted to enculturate sex into our society, we might do it the way a lot of societies have done by enculturating erotica into our society, which we haven't done very much in the past, but which we're starting to do now. You know, nice, wonderful sexuality rather than disgusting, dirty sex.
How old are you today?
Oh, like in first-run movies. You know, there's a lot more wonderful sexual excitement in first-run movies than there used to be. It used to be like the couple would begin to kiss and then they pan to the fireplace, you know, or the waves crashing. Now they just show them in bed.
What's a first-run movie? What's that mean?
First-run. You know, Hollywood rated movies, not the kind that don't have ratings, you know, that you have to go to sleazy movie houses to see.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But first run movies are those that are meant for the general public.
Don't the porn films always have that though? I mean, I remember.
Oh yeah, that's why, yeah. You know, a lot of people got addicted to foreign films because they were the only places one could find depictions of real erotica. And, but they weren't first run movies.
I'm going to ask again about when I was in Copenhagen, I noticed that their so-called shops of their pornography shops and so on are different than here, because there they show the wares in the windows, just like you would show dresses in a dress shop and so on. It's out in front. Here, they're either covered with paper or the black wall.
No windows.
What's the public reaction to that? Because obviously, school children and old ladies, everybody walks by.